Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is titled Western Tradition and the American Founding. Recorded in 2025, host Jim Falk sits down with author, filmmaker, and presidential scholar at New College of Florida, Joseph LeConte, and John Mako, president of Founding Forward, for a conversation on the Western tradition and its role in shaping the American Republic, tracing the arc from ancient Greece and Rome through the Enlightenment to the founding documents. They explore how ideas about individual rights, natural law, and the separation of powers became the bedrock of American self-governance. We hope you enjoy today's episode, and don't forget to subscribe to the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
I'm Jim Falk, and thank you for spending part of your day with us, where on today's program we'll be discussing the Western tradition and its impact on the founding of America. The government of the United States traces its roots back to ancient Greece, Rome, and historic philosophers such as Plato and Aristotle. Considering their extraordinary influence on modern political systems, especially democracy, it couldn't be timelier to reconnect and reconsider the early origins of our government. This is especially relevant now as increasingly we are seeing evidence of countries slipping towards authoritarianism, a risk that some fear for the United States. Our guests today include Joseph LeConte. He's a best-selling author, an educator, and filmmaker. He comes to us from the New College of Florida, where he's a presidential scholar. He's also the director of the Rivendell Center in New York City, and his YouTube history channel is really great, History and the Human Story. He explores the cultural and political achievements of Western civilization and the American Republic. Also with us is John Mako. He's the president of Founding Forward. He describes himself on his LinkedIn profile as a champion of civics and American history. So lots for us to consider today. Gentlemen, so great to have you both with us. And as I said when we were in the virtual green room, I'm not going to ask many questions. You guys know each other. I've watched you on your YouTube channel. I may just sit back and enjoy the program. But to start out, tell me, what is Western tradition, and why should I care?
Yeah. Thank you, Jim, for being on the show. It's great to be with my friend John Mako. I know we're going to have a robust discussion. Look, there are different ways you can define Western civilization or the Western tradition. Here's a shorthand for us. It's the centuries-long interaction between Greek and Roman culture, the Greco-Roman culture, transformed by Judaism and Christianity, transformed again by the technological, the scientific, and the philosophical revolutions of the 17th and 18th centuries. So geographically, yeah, we're talking Europe, we're talking the United States, we throw in our Canadian friends. But that's part of the amazing thing about Western civilization. It's, in some ways, it's expanded around the globe, but it's defined by a set of pretty clearly articulated ideas and concepts of ideals, values, institutions that you think distinctively, this is what makes up Western civilization and distinguishes it from other civilizations.
Is the term Western really the term we should use? I mean, if we were starting over, would you try to perhaps come up with another characterization?
John, you want to take that? I've got an opinion about that. Go ahead.
So I think what Joe touched on, maybe Jim, kind of answers that question. Global civilization is very Western, if there is such a thing. If you look at governments around the world, they call themselves democratic republics. Whether they are or not, they want to be, or they want to be seen as that. They want a veneer, at least, of Western civilization. So I think that geographically, Western civilization doesn't really describe it, certainly in its present state, because it is truly global, this civilization that Joe just described.
Jim, to your point, one of the things that's just so remarkable, and the great British historian Neil Ferguson is pointing this out in his book called Civilization, that we have to somehow explain the mystery of how did Western civilization come to dominate the thinking of really the global community for the last 500 years. We can debate what kind of influence China is going to have and is now having on the world. But if you think about the things that people take for granted, government by consent of the governed, a free market economy, drinkable water, a competent technology and all this, it really comes out of the West, and we'll get into it in the discussion, but it is a bit of a mystery trying to explain how and why did Western civilization, as we understand it, how did it come to dominate really the globe in so many ways?
And the evidence that we see in terms of just the flourishing of humans, right, which doesn't start to happen in the way we see it today until there is this thing that we're calling in this program Western civilization. And you see little, if you go back 50,000 years and you go back 25,000 years and 10,000 and 5,000 years, the human condition is almost exactly the same. And it's not very happy. And then this Western civilization comes in, and within 2,000, 3,000 years, everything is transformed, especially in the last, as Niall Ferguson says, couple hundred years, which is really a remarkable thing if you look at human history.
Well, you know, one of the things I often think back to is Colin Powell, who, of course, was our great Secretary of State in so many positions in government. And he, I remember hearing him say, you know, you can go around the world and you don't see lines of people trying to get into, standing in line to get a visa to go to China or go to Korea or even some European countries the way you do for people wanting to come to this country, legally, let's hope. And I think people want to come here, yes, for economic potential and opportunities, but also for something else. And that is, what are some of the themes of Western civilization? And I wonder if you might elaborate on what you think about that.
Jim, it's an excellent point. Think about people like Yeonmi Park. When she was 13 years old, she escaped North Korea. North Korea, even though it calls itself a republic, it's essentially a concentration camp, isn't it? Masquerading as a country. She escapes, she comes to New York City. She wants to unlearn the habit that's drilled into her in North Korea. She wants to unlearn the habit of not thinking for herself. She wants to unlearn that and start thinking for herself. But what she says when she told various interviewers, she says when she came to New York, she found that what she was experiencing there from the major media like the New York Times and National Public Radio and her friends at Columbia University, it wasn't helping her to think for herself. She found a cancel culture and a kind of self-loathing of America and American ideals. And here's what she said about what was transformative for her. She says, it wasn't the education I received at Columbia or following the American press. I was reading the old books, she says. I was reading the old books. There is a reason why, she says, the great books of Western civilization are all banned in dictatorships. Wow, the great books. That gets us into Western civilization. Right, we can begin with Socrates and the Apology. Let me pause there and give my good friend John Miko a chance to respond to that. It goes right back to the Greeks.
Yeah, and then let me just jump forward, Jim, and think about the fact that there were lots of reasons why people originally came to what was then North American colonies, and many of them had nothing to do with economic issues. They were religious issues and what we would call today First Amendment issues. They were freedom of thought, of religion, and that drove much of what happened in the early colonial and, in fact, in our founding was those kinds of issues as much as the economic issues.
I'd like for you all to drill down a little bit on the concept of equality, because when I think of ancient Rome, there wasn't a lot of equality there. And how do you then make that transition to where we went through, I guess, would it be the period of enlightenment?
Yeah, Jim, it's a big question. I'm going to try to give a shorthand, not too verbose description of this. Think about what we got from the Greeks and the Romans. We did get the idea of the individual emerging. I mean, that's why Socrates and the Apology is so important. What is Socrates saying? I must obey God, he says, not you guys. I'm committed to philosophy. He's accused of corrupting the youth of Athens. What he's doing is he's teaching them to think for themselves, right? Freedom of conscience in the pursuit of truth. That's a huge lesson, it seems to me, from Socrates. So there's an emphasis on the individual we're seeing in ancient Greece. And of course, it's the Greeks who first think, hey, we're not meant to live in slavery. We're not meant to be ruled by tyrants. We're meant to live in freedom. democracy. So we get this, we get the early ideas of this with the Greeks. The Romans pick up on it. And I think one of the great contributions of Rome back to Cicero, and I'll get to your question here in a minute, Jim. What Rome gave us really through Cicero was this concept of natural law. Natural law. There's a moral law, a universal moral law that everyone knows. Conscience tells them and informs them. And we see this from Rome. And then what happens? And this is where the transformation comes. We start getting the idea of equality. What do the Jews and the Christians introduce into the bloodstream of the West? Equality before a loving and holy God. That every person's soul matters to this loving and just God. Every soul, every human soul matters. We're getting the idea of equality, of human equality, mixed in now with these Greco-Roman concepts. Let me pause there and give John a chance to fill that out.
No, I think that's absolutely right, Joe. And this is what terrified the Romans, right? This is why they were not real big fans of Christianity, because yes. It kind of turned all of this on its head. And while there was aspects of that in some of the Jewish tradition, this was a very different kind of religious belief. And it was, of course, meant to be spread. And it really scared the Romans, this idea of equality, true equality in the eyes of God, made in the image of God. That was a scary thought for them.
Well, I was just going to say, the other thing is that I think is such an essential theme is there was skepticism and fear of power being concentrated. And you really do begin to see the seeds, if you wish, of separation of powers. And I wonder if both of you might take a stab at that. Joseph, let's go to you first.
I think we do have to give a nod to the Protestant Reformation and Martin Luther here, because what Luther did was he helped to redefine the relationship of the individual to the state. So his famous stand at the Diet of Worms in 1521, to go against conscience is neither right nor safe. Here I stand, right? Mm. That Protestant Reformation helps to launch a debate about rights, about human rights, about natural rights. And this is where we have to fast forward a bit to John Locke, my guy John Locke, in the 1670s and 80s. What Locke does is he puts together the idea of natural law, human equality, natural rights. And basically what Locke says is, look, if you want to protect these basic rights, these natural rights, these universal, unalienable rights, life, liberty, and property, you need a government that respects those rights. That's the purpose of government, is to protect those rights with equal justice. And that's going to lead us into something like a separation of powers, because there's no way you're going to be able to get a government that protects human rights unless you're able to divide power at that national level, one branch of government competing with the other. John, you want to pick this up, because you do so much amazing work on the civic space there in Philadelphia on this.
Well, you know, Joe, this is one of our favorite topics. And why do you need these three branches of government to be separated? Why do you need the diffusion of power? It's because, you know, man is just naturally going to do bad things if they get all the power. And that's also something that, of course, Locke and others really, truly believed. And I think the founders certainly did, the founders of our nation, that power in the hands of a few or in one branch will lead to tyranny. It has to be a balance, and one has to be balanced against the other, or it just simply doesn't work because of human nature.
And this is why the founders paid such attention to the models of government from the past. I mean, this is such a brilliant generation of political leadership, the likes of which we've never seen. They really were attentive to the lessons of history because they wanted to create something new, this republic spread out across the vast territory, a democratic republic. So they had to look at models that worked and models that didn't work. Rome was a huge example to them. You had a Roman Senate, you had these councils sharing power, but Rome ultimately becomes what? It becomes a corrupt empire built on slavery and collapses. They also look to Venice, though. I want to mention this point here, Jim.
I knew you'd get Venice in here. There was no doubt about that after watching your YouTube.
Well, as an Italian-American, I have to trumpet the Italians here a little bit. We spent some time with my film team working on this little documentary series on Venice in the American Republic. Venice lasted for the better part of 1,000 years as a republic with a separation of powers. So you had the Doge, not our modern day, not the modern Doge right now with the Trump administration. You had this sort of monarch, but his power was severely constrained by a Senate made up of aristocrats and then a National Assembly. Anybody over the age of 25 who was considered a citizen could vote. One man, one vote. So you had a separation of powers in Venice, and it lasted for the better part of 1,000 years. It outlasted Rome, and people like John Adams, they studied the examples of Rome and Venice and other places to figure out, okay, what's going to work here in the American context? It was a brilliant, brilliant stroke. Using history, if I could borrow a line from my friend Oz Guinness, using history to defy history, because the natural bent of every political system, every civilization is decline, right? It's decline. Use history to defy history.
So largely so far in our conversation, we've talked about political concepts. So let's spend a few minutes talking about private property, capitalism, and how that blends in with our subject of Western civilization.
So, you know, there's a lot of Lockean stuff here we could talk about, Joe, but private property and the idea that we have individual rights and a right to pursue our own happiness, right? The right of pursuit of property, which is a relatively new idea for the common man, if you will. Mm-hmm. And these ideas are expressed brilliantly, of course, in our founding. In the Declaration, in that great document, The Pursuit of Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, and that all men are created equal. All the things we've been talking about really in the last 10 or 15 minutes. And so the pursuit of property was key to all of this. And it was your individual right, not the right of the state to keep your property or take your property, but your individual right to pursue property. Joe, give us a little Lockean bent on that.
I was hoping you'd ask. I mean, this is where this other great book from the Western tradition, Locke's Two Treatises on Government, particularly the Second Treatise. And this is where Locke lays out he gives a theological basis for natural rights. And he defines rights, life, liberty, and property. And by property, Locke means much more than just our physical stuff. He means everything we produce by the work of our hands, the creativity of our minds. It's a broad understanding of property. And he considers life, liberty, and property unalienable rights. Governments are set up to protect those rights. But he gives it a theological basis. He quotes from the scriptures and says, every man, every woman is the workmanship of one almighty, omnipotent God, creator. And we belong to him. We don't belong to the state. And when the state tramples those natural rights, particularly property rights, it puts itself at war with the people, Locke says. 100 years later, the Americans run with that idea, don't they, John?
Jefferson, of course, takes the word happiness in place of that property. And that's quite intentional, of course, too, because he has, I think, an idea that you just expressed, that happiness is property, but it's a lot of other things. It's the pursuit of virtue. It's being a good person. Is being a virtuous person. That is really in part of that word happiness. And that's not really understood, I think, generally today. Happiness is, you know, a big smile on your face and you're content. Yeah. But there was much more to that word, I think, when Jefferson wrote it.
Well, you know, I think one of the issues right now is probably the men and women who serve in our Congress don't think about these things. And it's almost, gentlemen, as if people are afraid, if you wish, they're reluctant to reflect on some of these philosophical questions about how our government was really founded. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I completely agree with you, Jim. There's an amnesia at several levels, isn't there? One of the foundational ideas that the American founders got hold of, which goes back really to the classical Christian tradition. They didn't invent it. It's this idea that, okay, freedom requires virtuous citizens. I'm going to borrow here from my friend Oz Guinness again. Freedom requires virtue. Virtue, to have virtuous citizens, you really need a faith commitment, some kind of religious commitment. So there's an eternal triangle in the American system. Freedom requires virtue. Virtue requires faith. What kind of faith? Not an established church, not coerced religion, but a free market of religion. That's the eternal triad. Freedom requires virtue. Virtue requires faith. Faith requires freedom. The American founders understood that, and they put that concept at the heart of our constitutional order. And I think it helps to explain the success of the American experiment and incredible prosperity and creativity. John, what do you think?
To Jim's question, I think the whole word virtue is kind of out of favor. You know, to say something is virtuous, I think people are afraid of that word. They really are, and it's a tragedy because we can't have a democratic republic that works without virtuous citizens. We can, and that's what we teach all the time: is how to be a virtuous citizen, a good citizen, a virtuous citizen. And without that, yes, it will not work. It will not work. Yes. I'll take one thing, Joe, and I wonder if you would comment on this. So I've always wondered, though, you've got guys like Franklin and some of the other deists. I'll call them deists. We could argue about that too.
Yeah.
That talk about virtue and talk about the importance of Christianity specifically in creating that among the citizens. But I often get the idea that they didn't really think they needed it.
Oh, that's interesting.
and I really mean that. You read because they'll say on one hand they're not really buying this, right? And on the other hand, it's really important that we have it. So, Joe, we've not really talked about this, Joe.
But that's a fascinating question. I think I can't give a general answer to that because the founders were so distinct, you know, in their own faith commitments, and often it's hard to know what their actual faith commitments were. Where is Washington's faith commitments? He seems to be very sincere in his acknowledgement of providence.
Yeah. Well, one thing I was going to say, they are, despite we call them the American founders and hold them up in high esteem, at the root, they were still politicians.
Yes. Yes.
This is true.
Yes, they are.
So one of the things I like to do on the program is give our viewers an opportunity to sort of go and learn more. Two or three books, if someone really wanted to get a stronger foundation on Western civilization, where should they turn?
You know, I mentioned a moment ago Neil Ferguson's book on civilization, The West and the Rest. That is a fabulous single volume look at Western Civ, I think. Great place to start for Western Civ. But I do want to recommend a more modern book as well, Jim, on the 20th century. And it really helps to show, okay, we had these Western ideas about universal moral laws. What happens when we reject that tradition? What happens when political societies reject that classical Christian tradition? And that's what Paul Johnson does in his amazing book on the 20th century, Modern Times. And it came out probably 40 years ago now, but it's still, I think, the best single volume philosophical, political look at the 20th century and how we got fascism, communism, totalitarianism. It was all the rejection of the Western tradition. So that's a good book to have in your hands to think about, okay, what happens if we reject the classical Christian tradition? What happens? The 20th century happens, the caveman century. That's what happens.
So, gentlemen, this is a tough one. Are you seeing anything now that's taking place in the United States that gives you pause to say that we are rejecting Western tradition?
Yes.
That's a safe answer, maybe. Elaborate.
Want to unpack that, John, a little bit, and then I'll jump in.
Well, let's go to the freedom of thought, and which I think is, you know, it's that indispensable right, and it's the one Socrates died for. It's going back to the Greeks, and I do think there's a real, and it's coming from all sides of the political spectrum, an attack on thought, not just freedom of press, but really free thought. You're seeing it in academic circles, you're seeing it in political circles, and it is really, it seems to be everywhere. There's a fundamental issue with the First Amendment in the United States in that people do not appreciate it anymore. It is not seen as indispensable. Most Americans in one survey believe that the First Amendment goes too far in protecting free speech. This is, I think, a really scary proposition, because if we don't have, it really is the right that follow, you know, all the other rights follow from that one. And and I think that's a fundamental Western idea. Joe, your thoughts on that?
Yeah. Speaking now as someone who's taught at the college and university level for the better part of 15 years and watching what's happened in the academy, you don't have Ivy League schools anymore that think that Western civilization should be at the core. They've dropped those classes, and it's hard to find a quality school on the secular side that takes that tradition, that great inheritance that we have in the West, that takes it seriously. Not only doesn't take it seriously, but is set up, dead set up against it, and sees Western civilization as just a story of racism, colonialism, wars, and all the rest of it, and cannot discern the good in the darkness. And sure, there's plenty of darkness, gentlemen. Let's acknowledge it in Western civilization. It's the good, the bad, and the ugly. That's one of my opening lectures typically in Western civ, the good, the bad, and the ugly. There's plenty of bad and ugly. But for the love of God, if I could use that expression, what we've achieved, what we've brought about in terms of human flourishing, the protection of individual rights, unparalleled in the history of the world.
And on that note, I'm afraid we're going to have to close the program. And as you said, John, it's not just one side of the aisle. It's really happening on both sides, and that's why it's so serious. I want to thank Joseph and John. What a great conversation. Enjoyable, lively, and even told us which books to read. And I think all of us have a much better, greater understanding and appreciation now of the roots of our political system and civil society. Hey, where do we go from here? The next step in our discovery will be on the following program, when we discuss the failure of our schools to effectively teach civics. It's a problem that needs immediate attention. Fortunately, John and his colleagues are making enormous strides in changing the curricula across the country. So again, everyone, thanks for watching Perspectives Matter, where we talk about things that matter with people who care.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.